that begins with David's cataclysmic sin of both adultery and murder in the context of Bathsheba and her husband Uriah Hachiti. And as part of the penalty, as part of the punishment that David suffered as a result of that, God told him, Hinini ani mekim alecha ra'a mi beisecha, that I am going to bring upon you a kind of horror from within your own household. And there are many elements of this, but it seems like Avshalom and the narrative surrounding Avshalom is really the most consequential of all of them. And, you know, the rebellion of Avshalom, in one sense, ends with the restoration of David's monarchy. But we noted that there were some very troubling signs, even as David emerges once again, or reemerges onto the throne. And these had to do with questions relating to David's attachment to the people, which we'll revisit in just a moment, as well as the people's attachment to David. And what I mean by that is the following. So as you'll recall, from last year, we discussed how disturbing it was to David's leading general, a person who's a very complex figure, a very violent figure, Yoav ben Tzruya, who happens to be David's nephew, that even though David's men achieved a great victory, a very unlikely victory over Absalom and his forces, David was in a state of mourning over his son. And he just said, Absalom b'ni, he says b'ni seven times, and he doesn't express any sense of either gratitude for the people who just risked their lives for him, or any sense of relief that Avshalom, who was seeking to overthrow him and at best, replace David, at worst divide the Jewish people, that this, you know, existential threat to Klal Yisrael has been removed. And, you know, that's not the kind of behavior that we would expect from a leader. That itself raises questions about David's fitness, his ongoing fitness for the position. Nobody could blame a father for being troubled, to see the demise of his son. On the other hand, the question of, is David really in a position to be a national leader, if he can't recognize, what Avshalom represented, is a very important question. And that's something that we're going to, have to really interrogate as we go forward. So that was one piece. Now, the second piece is, and this is getting, pretty granular, so again, it's worth reviewing. Remember that David had fled to the eastern bank of the Jordan, the Transjordan, what we call the Eiver HaYarden, when Avshalom had seized Yerushalayim. And David remains there until the rebellion is destroyed, and then he crosses back over the Yarden. The moment that he's crossing back over the Yarden, there's a confrontation between David's own tribe, the tribe of Yehuda, the tribe that he started with, where David was, to review, first the king of Yehuda for 7 years and 6 months before he was the king over the entire Jewish people. And there's a kind of a conflict between the tribe of Yehuda and the rest of the Jewish people about who sort of, is, really the tribe that's closely affiliated with David, and kind of the seeds of what should have been a moment of national unity, what should have been a moment where the Jewish people were able to come together again in a moment of healing after this, real threat, is anything but that. And of course, this presages what will be eventually the division of the Jewish people. The Davidic line, this is a sad fact, was only able to hold the Jewish people together for one generation, meaning you had David, you had his son Shlomo, and that's it. And from that point on, there was a fissure. You had the southern kingdom, what we call Malchus Yehuda. You had the northern kingdom, what we call Malchus Yisrael. And all of these cracks are already starting to appear. So that's, a very consequential element as well. The very end of the year, towards May and June, when we get up to that section, the civil war, the splitting of the kingdom between Rehoboam and Yeravam, who leads the northern kingdom. So we'll have a chance to reflect on, you know, some of these elements where you could say really the handwriting was on the wall. So in that respect, the quote-unquote victory over Absalom, David's reemergence onto the throne, is a much more complicated phenomenon than, you know, one might initially conceive of it. It's fraught with questions regarding David's fitness for the position from one standpoint, and from another standpoint, you have to wonder about anybody's capacity to hold the Jewish people together when, you know, they're having these squabbles at the very moment that you would expect there to be, you know, a great moment of national healing and national unity. Okay, so that's really where we left things off. Okay, so the way that we typically like to work, and this is certainly what we'll do going forward, is I'm just going to share my screen so everybody can see the sources that we're operating with. And then we'll, you know, have the opportunity to dive into both an old and new story. Okay, so just bear with me for 1 second. Okay, so I've subtitled tonight's presentation, The Wrath of the Givonim, and we'll just begin to scratch the surface tonight, and then, you know, we'll move ahead tomorrow. So anybody just want to remind me what we know of the Givonim when they first appear on the scene, who they are, you know, how they've figured so far in Sefer Shmuel. It's worth reviewing. Who are the Givonim? What is their history? Okay, Effie, we always throw it over to you.
They're not Israelis. They're not Jewish. I'm trying to remember who they were left over from. Where they came from. My mind's drawing a blank.
So all good so far. That was all very good. Okay, so basically...
Were they the people who tricked Joshua?
Right. Yeah. Okay, Naomi, go ahead.
After Joshua conquers Jericho and Ai, I think, these people show up in ragged clothes and they tell Joshua that they're from far away and they make a treaty. Even though Hashem has said not to make treaties with anybody who's local from Canaan. And they pretend that they're from far away. And then it turns out 3 days later that Gibeon is right there. And Joshua has been tricked into making a peace treaty with them. And then they're attacked and Joshua has to save them.
Right.
That's all I remember.
Right. Well, that was like... pitch perfect. Okay. So, you know, it's a very complicated story. And you're absolutely right. It involves this ruse. These people present themselves as being from, you know, very far away. And it turns out that they're actually indigenous, you know, members of the Chivi tribe, one of the seven major nations of Canaan. And they at least have the impression, in the telling of Rambam, they actually had a misimpression, frankly. They had the impression that the Jewish people were not, under any circumstances, permitted to cut a deal with the indigenous nations of Canaan. Now, it's interesting because both Rambam and the Ramban reject that and say, no, of course we would have been prepared under certain conditions to make peace, but they somehow didn't grasp that. And as a consequence, they felt they had to engage in this ruse, and they pretend that they're from very far away, and they want to make peace with the Jewish people because they see God is really on the side of the Jewish people. And then it's discovered, as Naomi said. And what happens is that the treaty is kept in place. Now, why would that be? After all, the whole thing was under false pretenses. This is what we would call, you know, in halachic terminology, a mekach tos, a complete deception, utter false pretenses. So how exactly is this valid? They totally misrepresented themselves. So what emerges, and you know, maybe we'll go back over this text next week because it's very, very important for our purposes, is that there would be a kind of a chilul Hashem, that it would be a desecration of God's name for the Jewish people, even under false pretenses, to have given their word of peace to a particular group of individuals and then to renege on it. So as such, this notion of chilul Hashem, of acting in a disingenuous fashion, even though, of course, if either party was disingenuous, it was surely the Givonim, it's a really fascinating idea. Okay, so there's kind of a middle position that's developed here, which is that we're not going to go to war with them. We're going to abide by this treaty, but they are stigmatized. What's the stigma? What do they have to do? Okay, I see Naomi nodding sagaciously. Go ahead. They're rendered into which?
They become the hewers of wood and the drawers of water.
Exactly. And specifically the context of the Beis HaMikdash, or since the Beis HaMikdash didn't exist yet, the context of the Mishkan. So they're sort of, you know, put into this forced labor kind of a situation where they have at least what was at the time relatively menial positions in society. They're the Chotvei Eitzim and the Shoavei Mayim. And they live in the city of Givon. And after the destruction of the Mishkan was in Shiloh for 369 years, so the Mishkan moves to the city of Nov, which happens to be right next to Givon. And, you know, they're integrated with the society as it exists in the city of Nov, right? They're working there. They're the day laborers. You know, they're chopping wood and drawing water. And so they're constantly in and out of Nov. Okay, so that brings us now to the next chapter in the history of the Givonim, which is really a chapter that has to do with Nov. Anybody remember the incident? Maybe the most brutal incident in all of Sefer Shmuel, in the city of Nov. If you want to remind us about that.
Killing of the Kohanim?
Yeah, okay. So Effie, just bring us all up to speed, put us on the same page.
Excuse me, yeah.
Yeah, so go ahead. So how did the Kohanim end up getting slaughtered there? Oh, did we lose Effie? Okay.
I have two things going.
Okay, I think we lost Effie for a second. Okay, so in any event, Effie had said it correctly, that the city of Nov, which is a city of Kohanim, it's where the Mishkan was annihilated. And basically what happened was that David was being chased by Shaul, and David stopped there, and he asked for some assistance. Now, none of the Kohanim were in any way aware that David was now persona non grata. They thought, you know, here's the son-in-law of the king, the great warrior of Israel, why wouldn't we help this guy? And David presented himself that way. He said, oh, I'm on a secret mission from Shaul, you know, I'm going on a commando raid, that's why, you know, I don't have anybody with me, and that's why I don't have any food. So if you could just give me some food, according to some views, he actually took the lechem upon him, which is Kadshei Kadashim, the most sacred of the realm of the Mikdash. Very, very fascinating discussion there, and in the end, Shaul's henchman, Doeg HaDomi, happens to be in the city at the same time. That's a very important detail. David knew that, but, you know, felt that it was a desperate situation. And when Shaul gets the word that David was given some succor and sustenance from the Kohanim, he goes there and says, you know, what's going on? Are you guys part of this rebellion? They say, what rebellion? And he goes, you know, David's rebellion. Well, David wasn't rebelling either, but, you know, from Shaul's point of view, everybody was, coming to get him. Everybody was chasing against him, even though it was quite the opposite in reality. And Shaul slaughters the entire city of Nov, Nov Yira Kohanim. There's only one survivor. And we'll talk about the impact that that had. We'll go back over that text, God willing, next week, so we can fully, more fully appreciate how this factors into what is otherwise, I think, an almost inexplicable decision that David takes that we'll go over tonight. So again, the Givonim are impacted by this because either they're in the city, and according to some views, they suffer horrific losses as well. According to other views that we'll take a look at, even if they weren't actually killed, that economically they were really decimated because they were reliant on the city of Nov for their economic welfare. All of their employment was in Nov as the Chot Ve'etzim, the Shoev Emayim. So many different possibilities, but when Shaul wipes out the city of Nov, it's a catastrophe for the Givonim. And that now brings us to where we'll pick it up in the text, with chapter 21, what I like to call the wrath of the Givonim. Now, I'll just point out one final element in introduction, that there is a dispute as to whether this is actually a story that occurred, as it appears in the text, after the rebellion of Avshalom, which is the view of the Ravenel, or it happened earlier on, closer to the massacre of Nov itself, earlier on in David's reign, a number of decades before, and it's only being presented here, which is the view that the Malbim tends towards. So there are different ways of understanding this. My predilection, as you know, the Ramban always notes, is to assume until it can't be sustained otherwise, but to always assume that the text really is being presented in order chronologically. Yesh mukdam u'meuchar. Okay, so let's take a look at the first source here, and let's try to understand at least what the questions that we're going to have to investigate are. So the Navi tells us the following. Again, this is the first source. I'm going to put my cursor right here. And the method that we like to use, especially for those who are new, is we like to try to pose as many questions as we can in the hope that, you know, that will give us, in the end, a much richer understanding of what's happening. So, Vahi Ra'av Bimei David Shalosh Shanim. There was a famine in the days of David for 3 years, Shana Chare Shana. Interesting expression. 1 year after the other. You know, you would think 3 years. It's obvious it's 1 year after the other, but the text emphasizes that. Vayivakesh David et Pnei Hashem. David then sort of seeks out God. He seeks out divine counsel. And the response that he gets is Vayomer Hashem el Shaul vel Beit Adamim al asher himit et hagivonim. If you want to know why this is happening, it's because of Shaul and the bloody house that he slaughtered the Givonim. Al asher himit et hagivonim. Okay. So let's not go any further. Let's just hold it up here. And anybody sort of struck by anything here in terms of the Navi's presentation? What's interesting about this?
The language.
Okay.
Vayomer Hashem el Shaul.
Oh, okay. Right. It sounds like he's talking.
It sounds like he's talking to Shaul, who's nowhere on the scene
right.
anymore.
Exactly. Almost like it's saying this should have happened, right? Shaul should have been the one who was punished, not David. Now, what does he have to do with this? Okay, very good. Okay, what else can we at least raise a question about?
But David unwittingly caused it because he did use pretense to get the food and everything. So he was actually the cause of it.
Okay, so this is a very significant point, Eva. We might have to wait a week, but I'm very partial to this view that David's culpability here is actually very much a real question, and that he knows that. And even though, of course, he was in a desperate situation, that sense of guilt over what happened to the city of Nov is something that David feels very deeply. After all, they were killed for helping him, even if it wasn't his fault that he had to be on the run, and it certainly wasn't their fault. But David's feelings of guilt and anguish are very real, in terms of what happened to Nov, by extension, what happened to Givon. Okay, so that I think is really important. Eva, I think we'll have a deeper appreciation of what you said in about a week. But what else is just like really surprising?
What is that? The El Beit Adamim. He spoke to Shem spoke to Shmuel and Beit Hadamim.
Right. So,
what does that mean? I know literally what it means, but what's the meaning of that?
What is this expression? And there's not one answer to that question of, when we talk about, you know, the bloody house, you know, whose bloody house? Shri Bravanel writes about this extensively, the ambiguity of that expression. Okay, so that's a very, very important point. What about David's own conduct in this pasuk? There's something that's quite odd about it. And there's, in fact, a lengthy passage in the Gemara in Masechta Yevamos trying to figure out what in the world David was doing. Okay, so I mean, I know that the modern day news cycle has kind of been accelerated, but like, if the stock market collapsed for, I don't know, 3 weeks in a row, and the president didn't do anything, there probably would be people saying, like, where is this guy? If it was 3 months, you know, I think it would be, people would have trouble remaining calm. If it was 3 years, right, that would be really odd.
Rabbi, Mom said that, but we had mute on.
The dog ate my homework. You know, that's the Zoom version. So my mom, as usual, is correct. So Vayivakesh David as Pnei Hashem, like, what was he waiting for? It takes 3 years to respond to a famine. I mean, just by contrast, you know, when Paro tells Yosef his dreams, and the idea is that, oh my God, 7 years from now there's going to be a famine, right? They mobilize all of Egyptian society. You can't wait 3 years into a famine to first start trying to figure out what to do. This is not what we call in the field good reaction time. It's weird. Like, what? 3 years? Really? Vayakesh David as Pnei Hashem after 3 years? Again, the Gemara spends a lot of time trying to figure out what was going on. It says that David made a lot of false assumptions. He made mistakes along the way until he finally decided to do the right thing and look into it a little bit. And the answer comes back because there's this terrible unfinished business. The people of Givon, to whom a promise was made, albeit under false pretenses, but a promise was made, have been wronged, and, you know, the injustice has never been rectified. Okay. So now after that, Vayikra HaMelech LaGivonim. It's interesting. We always are very attentive to when the text switches between the terms David and HaMelech. So now all of a sudden he's the Melech. He's acting back as the king, like he's taking responsibility. Vayikra HaMelech LaGivonim Vayomer Alehem. And he speaks to them. And then there's this interlude in the text. VaHaGivonim Lo Mibnei Yisrael Hema. It's like, you know, reviewing as if we forgot. The Jewish people are not of the Givonim are not of the Jewish people. Okay, the Rambam makes a very big deal of this. The Rambam, twice in the Yad HaChazakah, references this expression, HaGivonim lo bimnei Yisrael hema, and talks about their wrath, as we'll discuss. Ki'im yeser ha'amori, right? They were from the indigenous nations of Canaan, uvnei Yisrael nishbu lahem. Of course, we had made them this promise. Vayivakesh Sha'ul ha'kosam, and Shaul had sought their destruction when he was in a state of, let's say, kinah, of some kind of envy over Bnei Yisrael and Yehuda. And we'll have to talk more about what this is, but say plainly explained, when Shaul was kind of rampaging over perceived slights and rebellions, right, he sought the extirpation, the ethnic cleansing, perhaps, of all of the Givonim. So this is, you know, new to us. There's no clear indication of this from the earlier incident with Nov, but it seems like Shaul was willing to go very far in terms of breaking the covenant that had been honored since the days of Yehoshua. So Vayomer David al Givonim, he starts to, you know, negotiate basically. Ma selachem uvamecha peru varchu es nachlas Hashem. Says, well, this famine, you know, it's been 3 years, and we're going to need to do something about this. And God has told me that there's this injustice which needs to be rectified, which is that, of course, you were wrongly persecuted. Many of you were killed by Shaul. And, you know, I may not be responsible for this, or maybe, as Eva was saying, maybe I do bear some culpability, but what deal can be made here? How can we find a solution? How can we find a way forward? So, Vayomer lo ha-givonim, the givonim respond to David, and they start off by saying, Ein lanu kesef v'zahav im Shaul v'im beiso, v'ein lanu ish lahamis b'Yisrael. We don't want money, we don't ask any gold and silver, we're not looking for reparations. Interesting. Some people remember the vociferous debate between Begin and Ben-Gurion about reparations in the state of Israel from West Germany. Maybe the most vociferous debate ever held in the Knesset. The idea of blood money. So the Givonim say, we will not take any money from the house of Shaul, and we seek no vengeance against the Jewish people. We don't hold them accountable for what happened to us. So David says, well then, what do you want? Vayomer ma'atem omri me'selach. And their response is fascinating. Vayomer al ha-melech, ha'ish asher kilanu, the man, let's say, who sought our annihilation, v'asher dimalanu nishmadnu, and who planned our destruction, mi'netzev b'chol gvul Yisrael, yutanlanu shivan ashim mi'banav, we want vengeance on him, and we will take it in the form of 7 males of his household, and we will execute them. Vehokanum is, we will then hang the bodies in that very location, in the home estate of Shaul, Givat Shaul itself. And that's the middle of a pasuk. And then we have what we call a psucha. The text is open for an entire line. And David's response is, Vayomer hamelech, ani etain. David agrees to it. Anybody have any ideas as to what this... I'll get out my telestrator here. What this open space is all about? This psucha. Very unusual to have a psucha in the middle of the pasuk. To the extent that we have them, we don't have so many of them. We usually have them at the end of sections, end of chapters.
The letter P will give you a clue. The letter P at the end.
Yeah, yeah.
It means I forgot what it means, but it means something. End of a section.
Well, that's what it normally means, and it's an entire line break. But the question is, right, so I'm saying, why do we, it stands for psucha, meaning an open line, but why would it be in the middle of a verse? What does that indicate to us here?
Maybe that it's something David should not have done.
Okay.
I mean, separating it from what they asked and that he, in his agreement, that he really shouldn't be doing this.
Well, right, I mean, Effie, like, you know,
the he was thinking, he had to think about it. The time he was thinking.
Okay, very. So I basically substantively agree with both of you, right? So I think the simplest interpretation is that David paused. He didn't answer right away. He was very conflicted. Yeah. He's very conflicted about this. On the one hand, right? You know, it's been 3 years of famine, and even if he was sort of late to arrive in terms of doing anything about it, you've got to do something. And he recognizes there's this, you know, unrectified injustice. But on the other hand, you know, Effie, it's like the Abravanel writes this really interesting essay. It's about 20 pages, but, you know, just distill one of the points. He says, you know, like, how many Torah violations, how many Surei Doraisa did this involve, right? Presumably, you know, the first and most major one is, you know, visiting the sins of fathers on the children. Poked avon avo salbanim. You know, it's like you're not allowed to kill people for crimes they didn't commit. And this sounds like a very strange form of justice in the sense that it's an injustice. I mean, how exactly does it make it better that Shaul shed blood to start killing people that, in a simple reading of the text, didn't do anything wrong? So that's number one. Number two is we know that when it comes to, you know, capital offenses, you're only allowed to adjudicate one case of dine nefashos, one capital offense per day. You can't have seven in a single day. And number three, and this might be the most significant from a certain standpoint, is that displaying of bodies is specifically prohibited by the Torah. The Torah says, in the context of the worst of the worst, you have four different forms of capital offense: skilas, refa, harig, and chenek. Skilas is considered the worst. Stoning, that the worst of the worst, there are 18 different offenses for which a person can get skila. Two of them, avodah zarah and blasphemy, birkas Hashem, are followed by hanging. And the Torah says, lo salah nivlaso ala eitz, that you're not allowed to display bodies. That's like totally against, you know, the Jewish ethic of, you know, displaying, you know, respect for those, you know, who are deceased. It's you know, really anathema to everything that we stand for. So, like, you know, the Abrava knows, like, how many Torah violations could be, you know, included in one act. So David had to have pause over it. So I totally agree with both Sam and Effie. I think that he did pause, and I think he paused because it was an extreme act. Okay. So he chooses to go along with it. We'll save the actual, what actually happens. That will be point of suspense for next week. But let me go one pasuk further here, because I think this is really interesting. Vayachmol hamelech al mefiboshes ben Yehonasan ben Shaul, al shavuas Hashem asher ben Osam ben David uven Yehonasan ben Shaul. So the king, David, has compassion. He doesn't allow, so to speak, that one of the seven that's going to be handed over to be Mephibosheth, right? Mephibosheth is the crippled son of Yonatan, David's former brother-in-law, best friend, who was killed with Shaul in battle against the Plishtim. So he somehow is not going to allow Mephibosheth to be included in this. Vayachmol ha-melech al-Mephibosheth, because remember, David and Yonatan have this covenant between them. And David, you know, can't imagine not abiding, not honoring, you know, when Yonatan saved his life, he promised Yonatan that he would always be faithful and true to Yonatan's descendants. So this is, I think, really, a really interesting place to pause for tonight. What makes this interesting? I mean, independently, it's something that I think we could understand very well. Like, okay, you know, David figures this is all a necessary evil. Really wish I didn't have to do this, but it seems like it's the only way that we're going to stop this national calamity of the Ra'av. But I don't want Mephibosheth to be a part of it. I think that itself would be really understandable. But what's of particular significance of David trying to honor, like feeling this visceral instinct that he needs to honor the covenant that he made with Yonatan? That is inviolable, even in this completely horrible situation. What's inviolable is the commitment that he made to Yonatan, that, you know, they would honor this promise. What's really interesting about that within this context, within this chapter in particular? I mean, how did we get here? Let's think all the way back to Sefer Yehoshua. What's so horrible about what Shaul did? So again, you know, killing people is bad, but for sure. But what was so grievous about what Shaul did in striking out against the Givonim, directly or indirectly? What was the What was the real
question? They were innocent. They didn't do anything wrong to him.
Okay, so they definitely were innocent. Definitely were innocent. Right. But I have to say, this is not my original observation, so were the Kohanim of Nov. You know, and their slaughter seems, you know, not to be, it seems, you would think that would be worse. And God seems not to be holding that to account. The Ravana was the first one to make that observation.
Is it the violation of the treaty?
Yeah. Sam, why am I so interested in that? Exactly right.
I don't really know all the terms of the treaty, but I assume it was for the protection of the Givonim.
Correct.
And so that would have been violated. And, you know, it's contrary to the Jewish values, for lack of a better word, to violate a compact, an agreement, a treaty.
That's exactly right. This story all started with a deception, right? The Givonim come, they deceive the Jewish people. The Jewish people really don't have to honor this treaty because it was all taken under false pretenses. But there's this sense it'll be a terrible desecration of God's name. It'll be a terrible Chilul Hashem if, even under circumstances of deception, the Jewish people would renege on a treaty. And from the days of Yehoshua ben Nun, you know, half a millennium earlier, you know, the moment the Jewish people crossed the Jordan River, effectively, this treaty has been honored. Then Shaul goes and, you know, he is prepared to throw away this treaty. And that is something which is, you know, really grievous. Killing people is always bad, you know, innocent people. But, you know, this is something that's really grievous. So I'm just trying to point this out in the context of David's initial reaction after he agrees to hand over seven representatives of Shaul's household. Just really striking. Because what's his first instinct? Oh, what can't I do?
Bring my personal promise to Jonathan.
I've got promises to keep. So, it's really striking. Promises kept, promises broken. Covenants honored, covenants desecrated. So here's something very interesting. We have a lot of work to do to figure out whether David's making the right choice here. Do you really address the bloodshed of the innocent by shedding the blood of the innocent? Especially in such a brutal way. But, or what appears to be the blood of the innocent. To get, you know, there are many views on this topic. But what is really noteworthy is that you do see some of David's virtue here. And virtue which is of the essence of the story. Because the whole story is about the violation of a national historical covenant that we had to give up. You do not break your word. That was the ethos that Yehoshua laid down. They tricked us, but we're not going to behave that way. We stand for something different. Remember that expression that we saw? Hagivonim lo mibnei Yisrael hema. They are not of the Jewish people. And we have to maintain that kind of national purity. Shaul compromised that. So you see that David's in a very difficult spot. And he's trying to figure out how he can both respond to the national problem, the Ra'av, and at the same time, right, to honor his personal promises and his values. It's a somewhat provocative thought to end with, but I'd like to end on this thought for you to consider. I'm ambivalent about this point myself, but I'd like to raise it for your consideration. Going back to one of our earlier observations, it is just totally incredulous that David could have waited 3 years into a famine before doing anything about it. It's just completely bizarre. Okay, so and I mean, next week I'm going to present the Gemara's answers. You know, the Gemara thinks that David just made a series of miscalculations. He thought he knew what was going on, then he thought it was something else, and then, you know, he realized that the whole thing was a house of cards. So again, a little bit provocative, but I just wanted to raise the possibility, was David kind of avoiding confronting this? In some sense, did he know what this was about? Did he have a feeling as to what this was about and what it would require in being put in this situation? I always wonder about that. And it's something that I think is worth considering. And, or, I'm not saying these are mutually exclusive, but to come back to the question of chronology, I'm going to make a sort of a full-throated argument next week that this really did happen after the rebellion of Absalom. It's exactly the way that it's presented. To what extent do we think that in the immediate aftermath, let's say the 3 years that immediately followed that rebellion, David either felt inadequate in terms of being the king to do anything? In other words, he was just overthrown by his son, and you know, he's restored to the throne, but he's not really prepared to act as a national leader. Is he still in mourning over Absalom? And that explains this kind of very slow response. So I'm just raising a number of possibilities as to, you know, how exactly, some things to consider for next week, how exactly David would have been so slow to react to this, you know, looming national disaster. So hopefully next week we'll pick it up, you know, same time, same place. Getting a very special welcome to all those who are joining us for the first time. As we like to say, you know, don't go anywhere. I mean, Monday's at 8:15. You don't have to stay here all week. People have things to do. But in any event, you know, we hope to see you. And, you know, as they say in the field, it's really good to be back, you know. Sort of missed this, so. Okay.
Shakoch.
Good night, everybody.
Thank you.
Thanks,
Shabbat. Thank you. Good night, everybody.
Good night, thank you.
Good night. Shakoch again. Take care.
Thank you.